our next agenda is we're going to start talking about the basics of drought contingency plans. Our next presenter is Dallas Mount. Dallas serves as the southeast area of Wyoming as a livestock systems extension educator with the University of Wyoming. Dallas's background includes ranch work in cow-calf, yearling, feedlot, and hay production segments. He received both his bachelor's and master's degree from Colorado State University. His passions include teaching profit and resource-focused ranch management workshops, where he constantly learns from innovative ranchers. Dallas co-developed the High Plains Ranch Practicum School, an 8-day systems-based ranch management school focused on economics, range, and forage, production, and people. Dallas still manages to get his boots dirty as he operates and manages an intensive grazing farm near Wheatland, Wyoming. Dallas?
All right. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate that. Okay, I'd like for you guys that are sitting out there to designate somebody to walk up to the computer and in that question and answer block, like Lucy asked you to do, type your name or type something. I want to see if people are alive out there. So in the question and answer block, and on my computer it shows up right underneath my screen. There should be a little box down in there for you to type. Just type something in there so I know you're alive out there, because I want to encourage you to interact with me as we go through this presentation. I've sat through enough of these webinars that I realize they can be kind of eye rollers sometimes. So we're going to try to make this as engaging as possible, but that would help me anyway, because I'm going to be asking you some questions and asking for you to respond. And good, I see some names now popping up on the left there. So looks like we're off and rolling. So we're going to talk about some drought management ideas. I know this is focused on the federal permittee programs, but I think a lot of the concepts to me have broad application, whether you're a permittee or not, and how you're going to manage these, how you're going to position your business to be successful even in the face of drought, because just as Chris said, just because drought doesn't look like it's on the forefront or at least banging down the door yet this year, it certainly will be again at some point, and you're definitely wise to position your business to be successful in the face of drought. So let's get on with it. Here's what the kind of way we're going to outline this first session anyway. We're going to talk about the variable forage production in our systems that we operate in, and look at what some of the data suggests as far as the degree of that variation. And then we're going to talk about how we might structure our business with that variation in mind. We're going to look at predicting forage production. How do we know when the drought is going to happen? How do we know when these critical dates are? And what might we do from a business management perspective to set our business to have these timing of these decisions that need to happen based upon some target dates. This fella in the picture on the right over here, I think he might have waited just a bit too long to make those decisions. So we're going to hopefully give you guys some strategies and tools to make those decisions earlier in time to those target dates. And then really what do we do with this information? And I think the stocking strategies for the variable forage production, it to me is a main component of what do we do with that information. So that's where we're going to go today. And again, I'm going to ask for your participation as we go through this. So let's get started. Here's my first question to you. At the coffee shop, when we're thinking about drought and we're in a drought year, what kind of things do we discuss? What are some of the topics of discussion at the coffee shop related to drought? So I want you to start throwing some of those answers, and your answer could be one or two or three words. Type them into that box there at the left side, and we can start filling this bubble in here. What are some things that we discuss at the coffee shop related to drought? All right. Appreciate the input coming in there. Just start throwing them up. Somebody said the rain. I think that's absolutely right. Let's get some more going here. The heat. All right. Yeah. How hot is it out there? Storage water supplies might be another one. There we go. Appreciate that from Bighorn County. The snow, and it's cutting off on me a little bit, but I'm assuming you're going to say the snowpack. Stocking rates. I like that one. Stocking rates mean essentially how many head we have on how many acres. That's the way I'm interpreting that. What might be, let me throw one up there for you. The markets and what the markets might be doing. Why do you think I have these two bubbles outlined the way we do? We've got a blue circle here, an outer ring, and then this yellow inner ring. Well, if anybody's read some of Stephen Covey's work, I'm going to write him up here because he might be a good one for you to. And you're going to get to enjoy my misspellings today, so I don't know if Stephen's a VN or a PHEN, but either way, it's close enough. Stephen Covey wrote a famous book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I'm not sure if it was that book or another one, but he outlined these two rings, and he gave these rings different names. And this out one would be our zone of concern, or things that we're worried about that might affect our business. What are things going on that are going to have an effect on our business? So if that's our zone of concern, then what do you think this inner one here is? It's a zone of influence. And inside that ring are the things that we can affect, that we have control over. And if you think about the things that we tend to discuss at the coffee shop or oftentimes the cattlemen's meetings when we get together, the real easy things to discuss are the things that fall within our zone of concern, but not within our zone of influence. And we can discuss, how much rain fell on your ranch? Well, what are the markets doing? Well, what's the storage water supplies? How's the snowpack looking? What kind of heat have we had this year? All these kind of things are easy things to discuss because they're things we don't have control over and we're not directly responsible for. But when we start getting into that zone of influence, these are the things that we have control over and the things that we as managers are going to make decisions on and have an effect based upon what's going on in our ranch. And I think stocking rates are going to be one of those. How heavily are we stocking the ranch? Are we stocked right up to the max of the average year or the good year or the normal year? Or are we stocked below that, allowing ourselves some opportunity to have some down years without having to reduce our stocking rates? However, if we're stocked below that, are we leaving grass unused? Are we leaving money on the table, so to speak, in those good years? So where might be that stocking rate? Let's think of some other things that might fall within that zone of influence when we come to how we manage our ranch in a drought year. So one thing I might think of would be destocking. Destocking, and I'm thinking specifically of the timing of that. When are you going to destock the ranch, and how are you going to choose to destock that? You notice I put there selling livestock, and that's a separate decision from destocking. Harlan Hughes often says destocking and depopulating are two entirely different management decisions, and we need to keep them uncoupled. And I really like that. I think that's a great way to put it. We can destock the ranch without selling the livestock. We might move them somewhere else. We might haul feed into them. That's generally a very expensive proposition. But those are things that we might want to consider. So those are definitely some things under that zone of influence that we control. I see some things coming up on the left-hand side that are getting cut off. Oh, there we go. If I click on it, I'm able to see it. Okay, just figured that out. Learning this system as we go. Thanks, guys. One other thing that I think is in our zone of influence that we really need to pay attention to are the type and kind of livestock that we choose to stock the ranch with. And what I mean by that is we might choose to stock the ranch with what are very inflexible or very difficult types of animals to depopulate or to sell or even to move. Or we might choose to populate the ranch with livestock that we're able to easily fluctuate up and down. An example of that might be a cow herd that we've developed through years and generations of breeding that when it comes to a drought, we're really reluctant to get rid of. Or we might populate part of the ranch with some taken cattle or some custom cattle. Somebody else owns them. They're paying us a grazing fee to bring in those animals. I realize we're talking about some federal permits, and that creates some different issues there. I think that's something within our zone of influence to consider as well. So The reason I bring this up, this zone of concern versus the zone of influence, is I think it's important when we start talking about management decisions to distinguish between the two of these. Do we want to pay attention to the things within our zone of concern? Absolutely. We want to watch the rain. We want to watch the markets. We want to watch all these things that are going on, because they're going to determine which management decisions are appropriate at these times. But do we want to spend the majority of our management effort within our zone of concern? I think that's a waste of time. I think we need to target our management efforts into that zone of influence and spend our time, our critical time and our best time looking at things that we control and that we can do something about. So big shock to everybody, I'm sure. That's what we're going to talk about here, at least in my presentation for the next part, are things within that zone of influence and how we do these things, what our timing of destocking is, what type of animals we choose to sell or choose to stock the ranch with. And that's where we're going to spend our time. So let's keep on rolling here. I appreciate the input from the group in the left-hand side there, and we'll be looking for more of that as we go on. I want to show you here a chart that was put together, and Mike Smith and John Ritten and Aaron Berger are some names I put on the front slide there. A lot of this information has been developed by these folks, and this is correlation of precipitation and forage production that was taken at CEREC. CEREC is the Sustainable Ag Research and Extension Center located over in Lingle. And this just really illustrative, I think, of a variation in forage production that can happen from year to year. Now, granted, there's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 data points on this chart, but I think the point is well proven by this chart. So let's orient ourselves to this. And why did we choose? At the bottom here, you'll see we're looking at inches of precipitation from March to May. Well, the reason we chose that date is on upland ground, on non-irrigated ground, rangeland ground, we found that this time window from March to May for the Lingle site provides the greatest amount of prediction for forage production on that site. So if we look at the old saying is spring rain makes grass, and that's certainly found to be true here with the data. So we're looking at how much precipitation did we receive during that critical window from March to May. And let's look at what happened in these years up here at the top. See if I can get a pin going here. From 2009, 2010, and 2011. And you'll see that all those years had fairly consistent forage production. We're right around here, right around this 2,200 pounds per acre of forage production. But our precipitation was even a little bit variable in there, wasn't it? This year we had 4.5 inches in 2009. In 2010 and 11 were very wet years during that window, but our forage production remained fairly consistent in there. Look what happened down here in 2007. Well, it was just a little bit less rain than 2009, but our forage production was drastically different. Looks like we're down here in the neighborhood of 700 pounds per acre in 2007 versus 2009. So there's quite a bit of difference in the forage production of those two sites. And boy, look at what happened down here in 2012. Just received just over an inch of rain during that period from March to May. And I think even that inch might have fell in the form of snow early in March, which was frozen ground and didn't get in the ground, because all we grew that year was about 200 pounds per acre of forage. I did some quick math on these, and just if we make the assumption that we're able to get about 25% of this forage that grew into the belly of a cow, then how many cows per acre, or how many cows might a ranch carry at these various forage production levels? So let's look at this 2009, 10, and 11. Okay, if I assumed that was about 2,200 pounds per acre, and again, we got about 25% of that in the belly of a cow, then that's what in the range science department they'd refer to as a 0.7 AUMs per acre. Okay, that's what the equivalent forage production of that would be. So if we had a 10,000 acre ranch that produced that, how many cows per acre, or how many cows total might that ranch support? Well, if we grazed out for 10 months out of the year, then my math tells me that ranch will run 538 cows. Let's look down here at 2007 and see where we're at there. In 2007, using the same formulas, this ranch here produced 0.22 AUMs per acre. Okay, if we had that same 2,000 or 10,000 acre ranch, then in 2007, we could run 172 cows on that ranch. And let's do the same thing for 2012. This one is 0.07 AUMs per acre. And this ranch in 2012, same 10,000 acre ranch, it could run 54 cows. So my question to you is, if this is our ranch, how many cows are we going to run? And I'm not really sure there's an easy answer to that. Well, what folks often say is, well, let's stock the ranch for an average year. Okay, so what would be an average year if we're looking at these 5 years? Might we stock the ranch for this level of forage production? Well, in 2009, 10, and 11, we're pretty well understocked, aren't we? In 2012, we're way overstocked. And in 2007, we're way overstocked. So the question becomes, where do we stock these ranches with this huge variation in forage production that we see? And it's a difficult question to answer. It's not an easy answer to it. So let's explore this a little more as we go on. But first of all, let's spend a little more time looking at what causes this variation in forage production and how we might predict that variation in forage production as we're going through the year here. So here's some interesting pictures, and what I want you guys to do is look at these photos. These were taken on a site north of Torrington, about up towards the Goshen and Niobrara County line, out doing some range monitoring with the rancher here. And this was taken in June of 2011, which those of you that remember 2011 in southeast Wyoming, we had an excellent year. So I want you to tell me what kind of tires they're running on that pickup, if you can tell. And also, while you're looking at that, I want to draw your attention to this cow pie right here. Some of the other things in the picture. So let's move forward 1 year and see how our forage production changes. Wow, here we are in 2012. Well, our cow pie is still here, hadn't really broke down. And I asked you to tell me what kind of tires they were running in 2011, and I'm guessing you probably couldn't do that because the grass was so tall we couldn't hardly see the tires. In 2012, you can pretty well tell me how worn out his tread is on the tires of that pickup. So I think this just proves the point. Now, I know 2011 and 2012 were two drastic examples, but wow, what a difference a year can make. And the difference in terms of forage production on these and this same site is just absolutely breathtaking. One point I think this also proves is the value of monitoring. Just, you know, spending half a day going around putting out some permanent monitoring transects. When we were standing there in 2012 taking this photo, we didn't realize how bad it was compared to 2011. Now, I know we could sit there and think, boy, I remember there being grass out here in 2011. But until we got back and looked at these pictures and laid them side by side, it really wasn't that profound. I work with a ranch that's located in northern Colorado, and it's a gentleman who runs a ranch for a board of directors. And he started putting out these long-term monitoring transects where he takes these photos at the same point every year. And when he showed his photos to 2012 to his board of directors, and he said, "Gentlemen, we need to destock the ranch," that was a much easier sell looking at those photos than it would have been with just him sitting up there talking about it. So there's a lot of value in these photos to help give ourselves a gut check to where we're at in terms of the year. Now I know there's a lot more value beyond that. You know, having the long-term plant composition of these sites is also valuable as well. But boy, a photo really is worth 1,000 words in this instance. So just a great example, I think, of variation in terms of forage production that we can see on these ranches from year to year. Little more information on the timing of precipitation and how that determines forage production. Mike Smith has spent a good part of his career looking at this question, and there's a lot of long-term data sets across the state that show a correlation between spring precipitation and forage production on these sites. let me take just a minute and explain this graph to you. As you look across the bottom, very similar to that slide two slides ago, we're looking at inches of precipitation from a certain window of time. So we're looking at a site here near Casper, Wyoming, and the time we're looking at is from the 5th of March through the 25th of May. Now, how that window came to be established was we took all this data, Mike took all this data, where we had all the precipitation records from the year and the forage production of what did that site produce, and he plugged it into a computer program and asked that computer program, what is the best window of time that gives us the best prediction model for looking at forage production based upon the timing of precipitation? And for the Casper site, the computer said, well, it's the 5th of March through the 25th of May. That's the best indicator in terms of when rain needs to fall to grow forage. And so here's all the different sites on this graph. So you can see as we get down to these lower points of precipitation down here, generally our forage production is going to be less. And the forage production is on the left-hand axis over here. As we get more rain during that critical window, generally our level of forage production is going to go up. And then you see this line here, and that's a computer-generated line that is essentially showing the relationship between the rain during this critical window and the forage production on the left-hand axis. And what this R squared means is that since that's 0.32, that means 32% of the variation in forage production can be explained by the precipitation during this time. You may think, boy, 32%, that's not very high. Well, it's not very high, but it's the best tool we have looking at timing of precipitation and forage production. So what does that mean to you? Let me click forward. I might have one more of these. Yeah, let's look at this next one real quick. This is a site near Cheyenne. You can see our R squared here is a little bit higher, meaning the relationship between the timing of this forage production and the timing of precipitation and the forage production is a little bit better. This window is a little bit different. You think of Cheyenne, maybe we have a bit more warm season grasses, so we stretch that out to the 21st of June. So you'll see that 56% of the variation of the forage production can be explained by the precipitation during that critical window. So what does this mean to you? Well, I think what it means to you is that early spring rains is what makes your forage production, and your window is going to be different based upon where you are in the state. So if you have a high relationship of cool season grasses, which is what most of the state has, is a higher population of cool season grasses, then generally that earlier season precipitation is going to be more important to you. A lot of the story might already be told on what kind of year we're going to have by the 1st of June. And I think that's a critical date to keep in mind. So, but your dates are going to be a little bit different, but they're probably going to be earlier than what you might expect. A lot of folks, when we get out into July and August, are still thinking, boy, if it rains, it might save us. Well, this information would suggest rains during the later summer have very little relationship to total forage production on the ranch. So those are some important things to keep in mind. Mike has a lot of these stations scattered throughout. I would encourage you, if you're curious what the information looks like closer to you, contact your local extension person, and they probably have access to the information that Mike has set, or that Mike has established throughout those years. I know there's a site near Saratoga that has a really long-running information, and their data suggests the month of April is the most important month in terms of forage production. So what target dates do you need to consider? Well, I want to throw out three target dates to you, and their relative importance is going to be based upon what your particular resource base is and where you're located. But I think April 1st, and I think by April 1st, we have a pretty good idea of some things based upon where we're located. And what things might we know? Well, we might have a pretty good idea of snowpack. It's hard to type and talk at the same time, isn't it? We probably have a pretty good idea on April 1st as to what kind of soil moisture conditions we're going to have. And my guess is on April 1st, you can probably pull up a 10-day forecast and see what they're predicting is going to be coming down the pike for the next few days. So those are the things I think you need to look at on the 1st of April. Let's say you've got a ranch that's predominantly upland ground, very little irrigation water that you can put on the land to produce forage, so it's mostly all upland. well, that importance of snowpack might not matter a whole lot in that case. So that April 1st date might diminish its relative importance for you. But let's say you're a ranch that relies a lot upon meadows for producing not only hay but also grazed forage. Well, that April 1st date is going to have a lot more weight in that situation. I like to keep things simple, so let's look at May 1st as that next target date. Hey, well, what kind of things might we know by the 1st of May? Well, I think by this time, a lot of the forage production story has been told by the 1st of May. So we're just right here, right now, okay? In fact, just a little bit further than that. Boy, if it's been bone dry up until right now, we're getting pretty worried. And I know around the state, a lot of folks have been able to pick up some timely precipitation events in the month of April, so things are feeling pretty good right now. And in fact, we're feeling pretty darn good down here in Wheatland. We're not going to talk about this storm that's on the horizon, because if we talk about it, it may not happen. But if there was such a storm, it might be a billion-dollar valued storm for us that would be coming in here the next few days. So we'll hope that that's the case again. So not only forage production, the forage production story is starting to unfold. I think, again, we can go out there and dig a post hole and see how we're doing on soil moisture. And I think we can pay attention to that 10-day forecast and see what the likelihood of some meaningful precipitation is in the near future. If all those signs are negative the 1st of May, it might be time to start looking at some actions to take to reduce the demand side. So we're starting to get an idea of how that production side is unfolding. It might be an idea to start looking at adjustments to the demand side by the 1st of May. And so what do you think my last date's going to be? Well, there you have it, June 1st. Okay, and I think June 1st I think almost all of our forage production story has been told by right around the 1st of June. Yeah, we might pick up a little bit more if it stays cool and the grasses stay active, or you're a high elevation ranch, you might extend that a little further. But I think by the 1st of June, it's time for those decisions to be made. So I would suggest that's really probably our last actionable date that needs to be in our drought plan, as far as looking at those different target dates. So that's what I would suggest, is in your drought plan, you have those target dates. Maybe yours are going to be a little bit different than mine, but I think that's a suggested dates for you to start with, is April 1, May 1st, and June 1, and then have targeted decisions tied to each one of those dates. So I'd be curious, if you have any comments on those, type them in the left-hand side there, and we can discuss them. But that's at least a place I think you can start and have some thought from there. All right. If you want to go ahead and type those in there, please do that, and we can come back but not seeing any action over there. Let's move to this next one. What is the right mix of livestock? So let's think back to those pictures I showed of that pickup sitting out in that grass field, and thinking about the variation in forage production and how extremely variable in terms of stocking that one particular ranch is during those years. Let's think back to that Lingle site where I listed out how many cows that ranch could carry based upon the forage production measured over those last 5 years. Let's think of those graphs that we saw with the lines through them and the R-squared values and how variable those dots were all along those charts. Boy, if that doesn't prove the point to you that forage production on these ranches where we depend upon timely rains, that forage production is extremely variable, then I don't know what does. And the relative drought risk, or even the forage variability risk, if you want to call it that, the forage variability risk is going to vary depending on where you're at in the state and depending on where you're at in the country. There might be, you know, if you had a ranch in Missouri, I think your forage variability risk is a lot less than if you have a ranch in the Red Desert of Wyoming. I think out there you've got an extremely forage variability risk, and you know, that one timely rain that happens during the summer might make or break you in the Red Desert, where in Missouri, you know, 20 inches of rain for them is a drought. So a little bit different on their end. So here's back to that question of what's the right mix of livestock? What are we going to stock the ranch with? Well, I think unless you've been living under a rock, you've probably seen some things that coming out from folks like myself and others in the business that are talking about balancing the stocking of the ranch based upon some degree of a core herd, or what percent of the ranch are you going to devote to a core herd. And oftentimes when we say core herd, we mean cow-calf pairs. And the reason we call them a core herd is they might be something totally different for you other than cow-calf pairs. But generally when you start talking about liquidating stock, folks are probably most resistant to sell their cow-calf pairs more than they are anything else. And part of that is that we've invested a lot of time and effort in developing those genetics. Maybe it's animals that are used to our environment, that are adapted to our environment, that know the ranch, that know the country. Whatever your reasoning is, there's a lot of resistance to selling off this core herd. So what percent of the ranch should we devote? And when I say percent of the ranch, I mean percent of your carrying capacity. So if your ranch runs 500 cows, then what percent of the total carrying capacity should we devote to that core herd? And what percent of the ranch should we devote to a flex herd? And a flex herd can be more than just stockers. I think oftentimes we just assume, well, that's stocker calves. There's a lot of different ways we could build a flex herd in there, and we can talk about what some of those components might be. But I'm going to suggest that if we're at the coffee shop and we took a quick poll of ranchers around the room and asked them, well, what percent of your ranch is core herd and what percent of your ranch is flex herd, and then we averaged all those numbers together, I would suggest we might find that maybe about 20% of the ranch is devoted to a flex herd, and the other 80% is devoted to that core herd that we're very reluctant to sell off in years of drought. So what do you think I'm going to suggest here? Well, I'm going to give it to you. I think that we need to look at and we need to challenge ourselves with putting a larger percentage of our total carrying capacity into a flex herd rather than a core herd. And that would allow us to be more flexible during those years of drought, to look at those target dates, to see those early indicators of, man, this is not shaping up to be a very good year. I think I need to make some adjustments. And then maybe not have the emotional attachment to those animals that we're able to make those adjustments easier. And if we have a larger degree of that flex herd, I think we're going to be able to do that in an easier way. So I think this 20% that we got at the coffee shop, I'm going to type it right in here, is too little. Okay. So if that's the case, what percent might we devote to that flex herd? And again, everybody's answer is going to be a little bit different. It's going to go back to that, what is your relative drought risk, or what is your relative forage production risk based upon the climate that you've chosen to ranch in. But here's some data that came from John Ritten and some others that built a ranch systems model. So they essentially took a computer and built in there an example ranch based upon a ranch that was located in Fremont County. And they put a whole bunch of variables on this ranch in this computer model. And that was and then they asked that computer model, they looked at all these years of varying markets and varying weathering patterns, and they asked that model to say, help us determine what the most profitable stocking strategy is for this ranch. And what that came out with is somewhere around a 60% devoted to a core herd and a 40% devoted to a flex herd. Okay? So that's, again, 60% devoted to that core herd and 40% devoted to that flex herd. Now here's something, let's operationalize this a little bit. Let's think this through. Let's say we have a 500 cow core herd, 500 cow core herd ranch. What's it going to take to make 40% of the stocking of this ranch be a flex herd? So let's say we're grazing 10 months out with our cows, and we're grazing 10 months out with our yearlings. We're just going to call our flex herd yearlings for the simplicity's sake. Just if we say those cows are worth about 1.4 animal unit months for every one of those, and a stocker might start the year as, let's say, a 475-pounder and in the year is somewhere around that 6 to 7 weight, I think we're going to need about 550 to 600 stockers to get to that 40% flex herd level. So that's quite a bit higher than a lot of folks would take to tend to say. You know, I hear a lot of, well, I keep all my heifers and I run them over to stockers and they're my flex herd. Okay, so that might build you in that 80-20, 80% core herd, 20% flex herd. Okay. So what I'm going to encourage you to do is look at ways to increase the level of your carrying capacity that you're devoting to that flex herd. So let me see what my next slide is here. Okay. So before we go to that, let's think about what might be other components of that flex herd. More so than just stockers, okay? Stockers are an easy way to do that. So help me think of some other components that could be a flex herd. I see I've got a comment typed in there from SERCD. We get 7.5 inches of annual. We got 2 inches or less this winter. What percent can we stock? Okay. So I think it goes back to, if you actually look at winter precipitation is not very correlated with forage production. You hear a lot of folks say, well, I'm going to do this to catch snow. I'm going to try to get more snow. Well, unless we get that snow moisture in the ground, it's really not very meaningful to those plants. So I think what might be a better question for you is, what precipitation have you received from when the frost went out of the ground till right about now? And how does that relate to what you should have expected to receive? And that might give you a little more meaningful answer as to what kind of carrying capacity you're looking at for this year. Also, I'd probably look forward here the next few weeks, and you might, if things aren't looking dreadful from looking back the last couple weeks, if you could look forward the next 2 weeks and see some likelihood of precipitation, then I think you might be not be out of the woods quite yet. You still might have a good year ahead of you. So that would be my answer to that. All right. So I haven't seen any of things pop up on what might be part of this flex herd. So I'm going to start giving you some ideas here. Aside stockers, I think it's really meaningful to look at adding some to those stockers. But here's one that doesn't get a lot of lip service, and that is take-in cows. Boy, there are folks out there that are just hungry as heck for grass. In fact, just today, I helped negotiate a lease here in the Wheatland area, and we're looking at near $50 per cow per month grazing fees for take-in cows. So there really folks are hungry out there to bring cattle in. If you can provide a service, and again, I know if you run on federal permits, whether it's BLM or Forest Services, there's some nuances that you have to be aware of in there. But I think using some take-in cattle or some custom cattle is a really something to look at as far as adding some nice flexibility to that. Besides take-in cows, I think cull cows. You know, if you look at the typical ranch is going to preg check their cows in the fall, and then we're going to sell cull cows after preg check. If you look at the seasonal market of cull cow sales in the fall, of all the cattle markets that we have to look at, whether it's calves or what have you, that cull cow seasonal market is the most predictable seasonal market that we have to operate. It's almost always lower in the fall, and then after the first of the year, it starts to tick up pretty substantially. So if you have a way to feed those cows fairly cheaply from that fall time of year and delay the sale of those cull cows till later, not only are you almost, I think it's 9 years out of 11, you're able to pick up on an increasing market from that fall market till, let's say, a spring market or even a summer market, you're probably going to add significant weight to those cull cows, and so you're probably going to change the class that they sell in. So I think looking at our cull cows as a flex herd, which would essentially mean if we preg check in the fall, let's put those cull cows in a different spot, you know, run them over a little bit longer, and then use them as a flex herd as we enter the spring. If things are looking good, we'll run them another month or two. If things aren't looking good, we can always pull the trigger on them. And then if we get to the fall and things still aren't looking good, maybe we preg check and sell that year. I think that's a strategy for you to look in as well. So again, those are just some ideas. A stocker operation, of course, take-in cows, cull cows. I'm sure there's a million other different strategies we could run to increase the percent of our ranch that we're devoting to a flex herd to allow us to more closely match the stocking rate and the carrying capacity of our ranches. So if you have any comments on that or questions on that, please type them into the left there, and let's have some conversation about it. All right. So let's move on to our drought plan here. Well, what kind of things do you all think should be in this drought plan? And first of all, the reason I have these two white squares here is they're to signify a piece of paper. If a drought plan isn't written down, it's not a drought plan. If it lives in Dad's head, and that's the only place it exists, then I don't think we have a drought plan. Okay? We need to have this written down and communicated and agreed upon by all the parties that are involved in the ranch before you have a drought plan. So let's talk about what kind of things need to be written down on this drought plan. And I don't think this needs to be a 40-page document written by your lawyer. I think this needs to be something that you get folks around the table, get a flip chart up in front of the room, get a whiteboard in front of the room, and start putting ideas down. And then when everybody's in agreement, it's put down on a piece of paper as bulleted points. And then we're going to talk about some of the components of that. So what kind of things need to be in our drought plan? Well, if I haven't hammered on you enough, I think we need to have a destocking strategy in our drought plan. Which animals are going to be the first to leave, which animals are going to be the next to leave, and which animals are going to be the last to leave. And maybe that destocking strategy needs to involve selling some animals, or maybe it needs to be involved relocating some animals. Okay? I would suggest rarely does it work to look at a drought plan that involves feeding animals as a profitable strategy. Sometimes it might work, but rarely is that going to work. If we start looking at feeding animals, especially for anything longer than about 30 days, in terms of a drought management strategy, it really turns negative in a hurry, at least the numbers I've seen do. So I would suggest that feeding, see if I can even, I'm going to see if I can select that feeding and reduce the font size on that. Nope, it's not going to let me do it. But anyway, I would suggest that one needs to be minimized. So what else needs to be in our drought plan? I think our drought plan needs to be tied to target dates. When we get to the 1st of May, when we get to the 1st of June, we need to look at our drought plan and say, hey, when we put this thing together, maybe this was done back in January, we agreed that we would take these target dates that we identified are important to our ranch, and at these stages we would look at these types of things. What's the soil moisture like? What's the precipitation conditions over the last 2 weeks like? What's our 10-day forecast telling us? We're going to look at these things, and we're going to start considering these decisions that are tied to these target dates. So absolutely, I think a drought plan needs to include target dates. I think a drought plan needs to deal with the people. Maybe a ranch that runs 500 cows in a drought has two employees. Maybe a ranch that's in drought that has reduced that down to 150 cows has one employee. I think maybe we need to have those employment strategies outlined in this drought plan ahead of time so that people that are working on the operation, that are relying on the operation for income sources, they are aware that, hey, when we're in drought, you might have to find a job somewhere else. Okay? I think that's a fair thing to put in there. I think our drought plan needs to deal with some financial aspects. If you're in a drought and you're selling livestock, are you in a financial crisis? Are you in a financial strap? Generally not. Generally in those drought years when we're selling livestock, we have a lot of cash income to the ranch. Now, our net worth is really not changed because what we've done is we've traded livestock for cash. But we need to have a financial plan in order to manage that cash so that at some point in the future we might choose to put that cash back into livestock. Or we might do something else with it. But I think as part of our drought plan, we need to think about how the money is going to flow during the drought. Generally, it's 2 years, it's a year to 2 years after the drought that the financial hardship really happens, is when we're trying to restock the ranch. And we also have those years when we're not selling as many calves. So that's when the real financial crisis happens, is 2 years following the drought, if we sold livestock. I think another part of your drought plan needs to be the health of your rangeland. If your strategy going through the drought is just to overgraze the heck out of your rangeland, then you're going to pay for that for the next decade or generations to come. So I think you need to have some range health objectives in your drought plan. A really good objective might be we're going to look at our long-term monitoring transects that are in place, and we're going to try to manage our plant populations so that we're keeping our most productive plants in good health through the drought. I think that might be a great objective in a drought plan. So if we've got that objective in there, then part of that range health is going to be some type of monitoring. It's going to go along with that. And this one might be a little different for you to think about in terms of a drought plan, but I'm guessing it's the most significant one, at least as far as we as people are concerned. And that's the emotional part of drought. Drought is extremely emotionally draining to those folks that are operating on the land. Those of you that have been through it know what I'm talking about. That can be the hardest part of operating a ranch through the drought, is the emotional part of it. Having to sell off animals that you've spent a lifetime building to match your environment, seeing the stress on the other people in your lives, feeling responsibility to provide cash flow to those folks involved, that is the hardest part. So I think and when we get on the front end of drought, years like, you know, right now where things are looking really good down here in my part of the country, years like this are the greatest time to sit down and write some of these things down in a drought plan. How are we going to handle these things in drought? One of the best strategies I've seen for dealing with the emotional part of drought is we destocked the ranch significantly. The labor side was greatly reduced. We took a vacation. We went and traveled for 6 months, saw other ranches, saw other strategies for dealing with this. Maybe we're going to take part of this cash income and turn it into an equipment inventory and build pipeline and do water development for the ranch and keep ourselves busy doing that. So I think all these strategies are great strategies to talk about on the front end of drought, because when you're in the middle of the throes of it, the emotional side of it can really cloud your decision making. So just some things to think about there. The last thing that I think needs to be on your drought plan is a spot for signatures. And those folks that need to sign this are the people that have a significant stake in the business, especially if they have ownership interests in the business, or perhaps they're up at manager stake in the business. They need to sign this drought plan, and that just shows that, hey, not necessarily that the 1st of June rolls around, we're going to sell off 40% of the cow herd, but this is our plan. This is what we've talked about headed in. When the 1st of June rolls around, we're going to seriously consider enacting these things that we did talk about back the previous winter. We're going to take a look at what the current market conditions are. We're going to take a look at all our different options. But your signature here means that you read and understand these, and you've bought in to the concept of being proactive in our drought planning. So I think that signature part is a major part that needs to be part of this drought plan. So I don't see any comments there on the left-hand side of other suggestions to be added to this. So with that, just a final summary is I think you need to have a written drought plan. If it's not written down, it's not a real drought plan. I think you need to have identified some critical dates for decision-making. Do some research. Find out what the best timing, what are the resources your operation has to work with, what are those critical dates that you need to have precipitation by, and then make those critical dates match up to the decisions that are tied to your drought plan. And then the last thing I think you need to do is look at the stocking strategy of your ranch. Does the stocking strategy match the drought risk of your operation? Looking at those pictures and those graphs that we showed you early, I think if you ranch in Wyoming, you've got some significant variation of forage production that you're looking at from year to year. And stocking the ranch entirely with non-flexible cow-calf units and not being willing to liquidate during those dry years is a recipe for disaster. So how do you stock that ranch so that it can be flexible? You can take advantage of the good years, and you can sell off those flexible livestock during the bad years and be ready to enjoy the next good year in the future. So just one quick thing you'll see right down here at the bottom is a reference to our ranch practicum school. We're taking registrations for that right now. We've got a school coming together. It looks like it's going to be an excellent school in the Laramie area, and also a school going on in the Kimball, Nebraska area. So if you're interested in participating in those, check out that website, and we're taking applications as we speak. So thanks for the time. I hope folks are still on, and I'll turn it back over to our moderator.
Thanks, Dallas. I don't have any questions from the audience, but as we prepare this the next presentation, John Hewlett will be talking about managing drought risk and tools to evaluate. I had a question, Dallas, about you mentioned, Saratoga mentioned that they only receive 7.5 at this time, and you mentioned one of the key things is to do a soil moisture to see that. Can you tell me how that is and what you're really looking for in that soil pit?
Sure, yeah, and in my opinion, that's just as simple enough as digging a post hole. We're looking at, you know, that top 3 foot of soil moisture, and we're just kind of gauging ourselves as to where we're at. You know, I think if you'd have dug that pit last year in the spring versus this year in the spring, you'd see huge differences in terms of where our soil moisture is. And that just indicates to you, okay, how critical is it that we need moisture within the next 2 weeks? I think if you'd have dug that pit last year, most of that soil would have been dry. And I think if you'd have dug it this year with the significant fall moisture that we received, you probably would have found some pretty significant moisture, just even a few inches under that top layer. So that's what I'm thinking about there, Chris, is just digging a 3 foot deep hole and kind of gauging how dry is it.
Thank you.